Good morning. My name is Tom Nicholson, and I'm the session chair of TH37, and Bobby Abouid is the co-chair. And we'd like to just give you some brief announcements before we start. Please silence your electronic devices. And we have question cards, and they'll go around the room collecting the question cards. So if you have a question, please fill it out and send it up front, and they'll be collecting the question cards. Today's session is going to be recorded, and all the view graphs you see will be available for you. So I think that's going to be a big feature. Could we go to the introduction slides, David? So as I said before, this is a very special session dealing with innovations. These are new and innovative technologies for decommissioning of and remediation of nuclear facilities. And we have a very special group of speakers and panelists for today. Before I go further, I want to identify Priya. Where are you? Could you please stand up? Priya was our session coordinator, and we really appreciate the work she's done. And next to her is Richard Chang, who also was very much involved in preparing today's session. So thank you. So next slide, please, David. Oh, let's see. Does someone have the controls?
This one?
Yeah, there we go. Okay. So basically, this session is to think about new technologies and informations that have been developed in the dismantling and decommissioning of nuclear facilities. We're going to hear a lot about the decommissioning of Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. We're going to hear about decommissioning in other countries. We're going to hear about new spent fuel storage technologies for prompt decommissioning by the private sector. And then finally, we're going to hear from the Department of Energy their application of new technologies at DOE sites. Well, yesterday, Bruce Watson had a wonderful session on lessons learned in decommissioning. And for those who missed that wonderful session, basically decommissioning begins when you no longer operate the facility by moving the fuel rods into the spent fuel pool. And then from then on, there's a series of activities that happen until you are assured that, yes, in fact, you can accept back the license. So the key technical areas for this session is innovative and remote robotic technology for dismantling and decontaminating to ensure radiation safety for the workers and the environment. And we'll hear from both Professor Yamana and Rod Raimondo on that. We're also going to talk about remote mobile monitoring systems for performing inspections and radiological surveys, advances in spent fuel storage technologies, and we'll hear that from Stefan Anton. And then we're going to talk about advances in modeling and engineering systems for characterizing and remediating residual radioactivity of materials and the subsurface. So, to my right and your left is Professor Yamana, and he is the president of the Nuclear Damage Compensation and Decommissioning Facilitation Corporation of Japan. Jared Bruno from IAEA can't join us today, so Bobby Abouid, my co-chair, will go through his slides with you. Next to him is Dr. Stefan Anton, who's the vice president of engineering for Holtec International. And at the end of the table is Rod Raimondo, Jr., who is a senior site liaison in the United States Department of Energy's Office of Environmental Management. So what we're going to do is we're going to have each of them provide a presentation, and then at the end we're going to have a panel discussion. So please fill out your cards with questions, and we do give favoritism from people with good penmanship. We'll probably read your questions first, so do your best on penmanship. So I'd like to just briefly introduce Professor Yamana. He joined Kyoto University for the study of actinides, especially molten salt systems. He became a full professor in 2002 and ultimately became the head of Kyoto University's Research Reactor Institute, specializing in nuclear fuel cycle engineering and related actinide chemistry. In 2013, he was named the president of the International Research Institute for Nuclear Decommissioning and later became the president of the Nuclear Damage Compensation and Decommissioning Facilitation Corporation of Japan. Today, he's going to be talking to us about the work, the tremendous work they're doing at Fukushima Daiichi. Professor Yamana?
Okay. Yes. It doesn't happen.
No.
Nothing happened.
It's going to be there. You
know,
there you go.
So, thank you, Thomas. Mm-hmm. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Firstly, I'd like to thank NRC and the RIC organizers and PRIA for preparation for giving me this precious opportunity. I'm serving as the head of the NDF, which is a legally authorized semi-governmental corporation to manage and support the Fukushima Daiichi decommissioning. And I'm so happy to be here with you. The purpose of my talk is to deliver the latest status of Fukushima Daiichi decommissioning and to introduce some technically interesting subjects that would contribute to the innovation of the decommissioning technology. So please note that I will call Fukushima Daiichi 1F for short. So firstly, I'd like to share the understanding on our current position along the timeline. So comparing the 1F decommissioning with the internationally recognized decommissioning steps for accident facility, that is of the IAEA's document, it enables us to understand our current position. Since the accident in 2011, various measures were taken to settle down the emergency situations, such as the contaminated water measures. Then, 8 years after the accident, we believe we have succeeded in achieving certain stability for controlling the risk at the site. So I can say that we have already come into the new stage for mid- and long-term cleanup. And in this new stage, recovery of the spent nuclear fuels from the damaged reactor buildings and retrieval of the fuel debris from the inside of the reactor vessel will become the major tasks that require some innovative approaches. Let's see the progress and the schedule. Severely damaged reactor units that suffered from core disruption are Unit 1, 2, and 3, as you can see on this picture. So Unit 1 and 3 had hydrogen explosion at the operating floors by which the housing and fuel handling devices were devastated, but luckily spent fuel stored underwater were free from serious damages. The current status of Unit 1 and 2 and 3 are like these pictures, and they are quite safely managed and works for the recovery of spent fuels are progressing for each unit. For Unit 3, the rightest picture, the devastated top floor has been cleared off by remotely operated heavy machines, and new building cover has been installed. By using remotely controlled fuel handling machine, the recovery operation is expected to start soon. The latest technical milestone set by the government's policy is shown at the bottom of this picture. So key milestones are 2021 for the start of the fuel debris retrieval, and 2023 for the start of the removal of the spent fuels from Unit 1 and 2. From here, I will explain the innovative nature of our challenge for this unprecedented task. The technical difficulties of the fuel debris retrieval from the damaged reactor units are listed up on the left. I can say that the features of the 1F challenge are the existence of uncertainties and unknowns. This is one. And another is the extremely severe radiation environment, which you never incur in the decommissioning of sound reactors. To address these difficulties, technical elements listed on the right are requested. Remote internal inspection techniques such as the remote manipulator, robots, and relevant instrumentations are the first order necessary requirements. Actually, the accessibility to the reactor vessel is quite limited, and special performance and durability is required for the remote devices. Extremely high radiation dose rate requires a certain high degree of radiation resistance to the electronic devices. For the full-scale retrieval operation, specially dedicated and unique machines will be necessary, and their development is being undertaken. Associated contaminated water management, atmospheric gas control, and other safety control, including the avoidance of the weak criticality, will become essential too. In addition, the analysis of the recovered materials will become another difficult task to enable the rapid and safer decommissioning. As an example of the importance of the special remote operation, I'd like to show you the preparatory process for the spent fuel recovery from Unit 3. As you can see, immediately after the accident in 2011, as shown on the top left, it was severely devastated and contaminated heavily. By 2013, remotely controlled cranes were fully used to remove the rubble to complete flatness. So it was a sophisticated remote operation from distant place. In 2015, careful removal of the large rubble falling into the fuel pond was carried out very carefully. So now a new building cover is installed to start the retrieval operation. So this new building cover was remotely installed by assembling a number of sophisticatedly designed components, like 1, 2, 3, 4. So now let me talk about the fuel debris retrieval. So this is the biggest challenge we are facing. So this slide summarizes the fuel debris retrieval strategy we are adopting. Fuel debris, which means corium and other complicated material formed by core melting accident, are thought to be dispersed at the various locations of RPB and PCV, and these should be retrieved safely by means of remote operation. Based upon the estimated status of each unit, we evaluated a few candidate methods to propose that partial submersion side access method should be the most intensively focused first. Partial submersion plus side access method is a technique to access from the side of PCB at the ground level of the reactor building without feeding water into the PCB. So we will work to start aiming at the fuel debris located at the PCB bottom by side access first. But we should be flexible enough to respond to the newest findings by adjusting the engineering decision. From here, I'll talk about the techniques that TEPCO has applied for the internal inspection for PCB, which is a necessary process before the retrieval operation. The status inside is considered to be like the left picture. For the lower part of PCB being submerged, underwater ROV is used to investigate the actual circumstances. The newest submarine type ROV is going to be applied to Unit 1 in this autumn, and this machine has multiple functions like ultrasonic sonar, neutron detector, as well as a high-performance camera. The two pictures at right bottom are the accumulated deposit inside the pedestal, in which a small object, you can see a...
There is no laser point.
Okay. A small object similar to a portion of a fuel assembly can be seen. So these deposits are believed to have been formed from high-temperature molten phase that fell down from the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel. Now, I'd like to show you some videos of the remote inspections applied to Unit 2. So this shows a part of Unit 2. The left is the structure beneath the RPV. The cylindrical concrete structure is a pedestal that supports the RPV. So it is considered that the molten phase formed by core melt fell down through the flow passes caused by an attack of high temperature melt at the bottom of RPV. An inspection device was inserted by using long guide pipe through the entrance hole of the pedestal. So the red marks you can see are the location of the inserted camera to look upward and downward direction. So let's see the video. In this video, the camera is looking upward to see the damaged control rod driving mechanism, like that. These CRD housings still remain, as you can see, and they seem to be fully covered with some deposits. Cooling water is injected into the top of RPB, and you can see that water drops falling down from the bottom of the RPB. So this is a similar video for the downward direction to the bottom of the pedestal. You can see lots of deposit on the floor of PCB. This could be fuel debris. But because we don't have any chemical information yet about this at this moment, so we cannot identify this to be a debris containing nuclear fuel materials. You can see the light-gauged metallic structure to support the operation platform, those at the level of the ground floor. The dose rate was detected to be about 7 sieverts per hour, not so high, inside the pedestal. And the temperature was around 23 centigrade. But the dose rate outside the pedestal was pretty high, several tens. So this gives a closer look to the deposit and the fritz at the bottom. You can see lots of rock-like broken debris or rubbish or stone-like one, fritz, in the water. So you can see the later concrete wall of the pedestal. You can see the steel structure there. And at the right end, you can see cable duct. Yeah, it's pretty healthy now. So very interesting. And you can see a cable duct covered with a very thick deposit like those. Okay, so remember this point. This is a place where the next video will access. Okay. So I will show you the next video for the latest observation of the Unit 2, which was carried out in this February. The purpose of this inspection was to check whether the deposit is movable or not. This investigation was expected to give a suggestion about the methods of retrieval. So using this long guide pipe, a specially designed camera was hung down to the upper surface of the deposit to pinch the solids with a movable two fingers like this. Mm-hmm. So you can see the two fingers placed at the bottom of the right picture. The distance of the fully open two fingers is 8 centimeters. And the camera looks down to see the motion of these fingers and the deposit. So as for the result of this inspection, I will show you a video for giving a sense of reality. So this video shows that several stone-like deposits were pinched up by the fingers. 4 or 5 stone-like debris is grabbed. Among several pinch tests, some cases showed movability of the deposit, like this picture. But in some other cases, the deposit could not be grabbed, meaning that the solid was much bigger and harder, so the fingers slipped. As a result, it was concluded that they could partly be recovered by less difficult techniques such as picking, sucking, or scooping. But still, we will have to prepare for the bigger and harder debris by using more powerful techniques, for example, boring, drilling, cracking, and so on. So more full-fledged inspection technique is going to be applied to Unit 2 soon. This is a big and long remote arm going into the inside of the pedestal to conduct a thorough inspection and sampling. Let's see the video of this new machine. This big arm, designed and fabricated by a British company, originates from the remote technology for the maintenance of the fusion reactor, tokamak. It goes into the PCB through a penetration of 60 centimeter diameter to measure the 3D mapping by laser scanning and detect neutron flux. Hopefully, in 2020, this will be used to take some samples of the debris at the bottom PCB. So this machine is very good for this Fukushima case because, you know, tokamak is a donut-like, heavy, big machine. And for the maintenance of the inside of the tokamak, they use a folded arm by unfolding this manipulator into deep into the tokamak. So this is very good for this case. So the sample taken from the bottom of the pedestal are brought into the annexed chamber to put them into a small can. And then this can is transferred into the cask to be shipped to the analytical laboratories outside Fukushima Prefecture. One interesting and unique challenge we are addressing is the analytical work for the retrieved fuel debris. In order to secure the safety during the decommissioning operation and to guarantee the long-term storage of fuel debris, knowing the properties of them will be essential. Because the 1F accident is of BWRO and is different from the case of Three Mile Island 2 and Chernobyl 4, the property of 1F fuel debris may be different from those observed at TMI and Chernobyl. So 1F fuel debris is featured by the formation of MCCI, meaning molten core concrete interaction, and by the reaction with boron. So various morphologic properties will be expected depending on the different kinetics of the melting and the solidification process during the accident. And so the analysis of the retrieved fuel debris will be the critical and essential path. In the meantime, existing hot laboratories operated by nuclear fuel fabricators and Japan Atomic Energy Agency are supposed to be used for the analysis. But because their capacity and the function are limited, a new hot laboratory is being built next to the 1F site. This is Okuma Analytical Center, which is under construction by JAEA. This facility is accommodated with shielded cells and various analytical devices that enable difficult analysis of refractory debris and waste. I'd like to say that the analysis will control the timeline and the safety of the 1F decommissioning as well as final waste management. So analysis may be a technical element of the decommissioning that requires some sort of innovations. Apart from the aspect of innovation in techniques, I'd like to touch upon the meaning of the first-hand information obtained from the decommissioning. Investigations to get scientific and technological information during the decommissioning operation is called forensic study, and this needs careful consideration and planning before the full-scale retrieval operation will start. As schematically drawn on this page, investigations from scientific and technological perspectives have multiple meanings. As the arrows on the left side show, it is worthy of improving TEPCO's safe and steady decommissioning delivery. But at the same time, scientific and technological investigation will contribute to enhance the world's nuclear safety. We should note that there is a possibility that forensic study would provide provide valuable information that can never be able to be obtained by experiments using simulant. Actually, OECD NEA and United States NRC, United States DOE, have had intensive discussion upon this significance. We, from the perspective of the duty holder of the 1F decommissioning, will continue to find practically possible forensic approaches through the discussion with NRC, DOE, and OECD. Having spoken about the difficult decommissioning challenges, I'd like to take a moment to touch upon the safety requirements and regulation. This is because safety regulation would exercise considerable degree of influence to the decommissioning. Currently, 1F site is designated as specified nuclear facility, which means this site is exempted from normal regulatory scheme. Accordingly, regulatory decisions and decrees are likely to be improvised. However, if we see the safety assurance for the future large-scale operation for over a long period, such as of the field debris retrieval and waste management, we will need to have more foreseeable and consistent regulation, because there should be limits in the available time and cost. Principally, the decommissioning of the accident facility should be carried out on the basis of the concept of ALARP, meaning as low as reasonably practicable, and the balance among the appropriate regulatory requirements, reasonably practicable plan, and achievable target level of the risk reduction will be the key for the success. Some desired direction would be comprised enhancement of a dialogue among stakeholders, including the regulatory authority, with its independence mostly ensured, of course, and introduction of risk-informed decision and perception, and flexible and tailored regulation that enables the quick reduction of the existing risk. So let me conclude my talk by expressing my hope that you'd keep your interest and on the progress and our challenge for Fukushima Daiichi. We need world interest to keep our challenge. So I'm sure that it will be beneficial to exchange information between the decommissioning of accident facilities and the sound facilities. Last but not least, let me invite you to the International Forum for 1F Decommissioning held by NDF. This is scheduled on August 4 and 5, held in the Safado area of Fukushima. So you will be provided with much shareable information there. So I'm looking forward to your participation. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Yamano. That was wonderful, and I love the pictures. They're just remarkable. Thank you. Our next talk is developed by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Gerald Bruno and Vladimir Mikhail prepared these slides. Unfortunately, Gerald Bruno isn't able to be with us, so my co-chair, Bobby Abouid, who's the senior technical advisor in NMSS, will go through the slides with you. Bobby?
Thank you, Tom. As you can see, I'm putting two hats. I'm co-chair and also presenting somebody else's presentation. I hope I'll be able to do a fair job. Good morning, everybody. Thanks to you for joining us for this session. Thanks to Priya and Richard. They did an outstanding job in coordinating this session. Of course, thanks to our panelists. They came all the way from long distances in order to be panelists for our session. Thank you again. The title of the presentation, as you can see, is related to international perspective about decommissioning and environmental remediation technology. And in this presentation, just we'll go like what is going on in the world as a whole, without going through discussion how the technology is applied, just to be aware of what's going on. So the next slide, if you, this slide here, so I will go quickly focusing on the optimized framework and the commissioning decision making in the context of applied technologies and present some practical examples. So I will not go through detail, just I will focus on the examples for the technology that has been applied all over the world. In licensing of nuclear facilities, there will be benefits and liabilities. And as you can see, that the most important factor in decommissioning and in waste management, because this comes in the at the end of the life cycle, so it is safety, cost affordability, social acceptance, and sustainability. So you keep in mind those are the four factors in decommissioning that we need to take into consideration, and the technology is the important part of it. So as I said, these are the main factors, and I will focus on the role of technology, which is significant for optimization of the decommissioning process by enhancing safety, reducing cost. Also, characterization is important in order to select what kind of technology for characterization. Support modeling and simulation, minimizing generation of secondary waste is also important to use the proper technology. And the effective decontamination of materials for potential reuse, how you decontaminate the material. So for this now, I will present example of technologies that has been used in different places all over the world. And the first example in this slide will show the virtual reality, I give it designation VR 3D simulation, which was used in CEA Marcoli facility in France. So this is an example of how it was used. The slide, the photos on the slide shows example of the complementarity of virtual and physical mock-ups to prepare dismantling operation. And on the left side of the slide, you see that illustration of VR 3D, how it can be used in the process for cutting and in order to select the sequence of cuttings, as well as to adjust camera position, tool rack design, and Maestro arm used in the dissolver stack. This slide shows the, just to convey that the technology strategy for safety criteria and for administrative controls all come together. So in order to select what kind of safety criteria and strategy for decommissioning, it is quite important to consider what kind of technology available to you in order to select the options for different kind of decommissioning strategy, and the focus, of course, safety and cost. This illustrates the hierarchy for controls in decommissioning safety operation. The most effective is the elimination of hazard from its origin. There are different options that you can do. Either you can select, well, I need to remove the hazard, or if you look at the bottom to think about, well, I need the workers, is okay if they can be exposed, but I'm to give them sufficient protection. Of course, if you look at the hierarchy, the most important thing and the option that you need to select is the one at the top, which is in order to remove the hazard instead of try to find some kind of protections for the workers. Of course, there are other options in between, but this is the important thing. How can you remove the hazard? And in this case, if you think about removing the hazard, the most important factor is to think about how can you remove it, and then it is self-evident how technology can actually support the first one on the top, which is how can you remove the hazard. Here, the following slide will illustrate, this slide illustrate the technology, how can assist in finding a solution during the commissioning. As you can see, there are different kind of options for decommissioning, and those are examples that I will talk about in the following slides, how what kind of solution was selected all over the world. Assessment of available and cost-effective technology is necessary for decision-making regarding selection of options among the decommissioning strategy, as I said before. For example, selection of immediate dismantling strategy, we call it in the United States DECON, should consider whether technology is available to do the process and whether it is cost effective or not and how you are going to do it. You have the skilled labor and the skilled people to do that. And also selecting other routes, you need to think about, well, if I need to select certain approach for dismantling and I need to have large component to be transported, I need to think about, do I have the technology that I could transport these large components? That's another example too. So whatever you need to think about for the option that you select of what to do in the decommissioning arena, you need to think about technology. This slide here shows photos pertaining to Magnox, Broadwell, Dungeness, A&H Hinkley Point in UK. And as you can see, there are options for immediate dismantling of the turbine halls. And also the other option is for safe enclosure of the, we call it deferred dismantling of the reactor for this case. This is the example, UK example. Here is demonstration of how technology plays a significant role in optimizing decommissioning for waste management from Magnus fleet through technology used for dissolution of fuel element debris. So it is important to select what kind of technology that can be used for waste management. And this example, fuel debris is important, how you handle it, and the technology for better segregation of waste. You generate different kind of waste with different categories or different classes. And the question is there a technology that you can segregate the waste and isolate it so you could manage it in a better way? Again, in UK, in their regulation, there is a question about, okay, what kind of this technology, why we are concerned about the technology. In UK, it is a requirement by the regulator is to use best available technology. We call it BAT. So in this case, it is a requirement, actually, to look at the technology and to look at the cost effective in order to remediate, in order to decontaminate. Here illustrate how the technology can be used in decision-making as to decontaminate or not. There is a question sometimes you have for large components, what do you need to do with it? Do you need to decontaminate it or do you need just to leave it as is and try to store it and or try to dispose it as is under different kind of waste class category? In this context, assessment of the availability of high efficiency available technology is considered as the driving force for decision making in this regard. This shows example how different kind of technology, though it can be primitive or it can be more advanced, that can be used for decontamination. As you can see, you could use, you know, scrubbing on the walls, as you can see in the photos on the left, or you can use different kind of instrument in order to scrubble the surface of the floor to decontaminate, at the same time to do measurement what kind of residual red contamination on the floor. And other technologies, as you can see, is not explained, but you can see it is heat kind of treatment. And recently in Germany and Netherlands and in Europe, they developed what's called as very high temperature heat, that is called plasma. They use plasma in order to treat waste and then to collect the gases and then to decontaminate equipment and material, and then for other kinds of uses and recycle. Here, this illustrates the technologies for removal of large components. Use of this technology depends on availability of remotely controlled high-speed cutting technologies. Lots of high-speed cutting technologies, if you attended waste management conference last week, you could see that different kind of exhibitors. They show what kind of technology for cutting, and they are different kind of technology, and they are really is more advanced. So the selection of what kind of cutting of large components, what methods that you are going to use for two factor to reduce the cost and also in order to reduce the exposure of the workers. This is example for laser cutting that used in Germany for technology for cutting RPV. This is in Greifswald nuclear power plant in Germany. And also other technology that is available is called arc saw cutting technology, which also it can prove to be effective technology that can be used for that purpose. Here, this is example 5, explaining the technology used for demolition of building. When you have buildings and large building, you need to think about what kind of decontamination, what kind of waste you are generating when you demolish that building. How can you remediate? In this regard, two options can be selected, either option 1 to decontaminate and the clearance of the standing building, followed by demolition, or you could do radiological control demolition under a tent. And I think this was shown in the presentation in the decommissioning section, how can you use a tent in order to control the atmospheric contamination, and then how can you contaminate. And of course, the important factor there, cost and efficiency, and reducing the doses to the workers. So surface decontamination, you need to look if it is going to be rapid or it's going to take a long time, and what kind of contamination and doses to the workers. Here, this shows the, demolition of the cooling towers at Calder Hall in Sellafield, UK. So technology is used in order to have to decontaminate and demolish after that in a nice and safe way. This is for Sellafield in UK. The site cleanup of the end decommissioning frequently required cleanup of soil. In many cases, for certain decommissioning facilities, could be power reactors or others, that soil is contaminated. And at the same time, could be subsurface contamination, whether in soil or in groundwater. So the cleanup levels may depend on the decommissioning end state of either you need to select restricted or unrestricted use of the facility or of the land. And it's important to try to see what kind of technology to remediate the soil. If you have soil that you need to remediate and you need to remediate groundwater, technology plays an important role. What kind of waste you generate also after a cleanup? Those are examples that they show for site release after decommissioning in Germany and the United States. is self-evident. I will not talk about it. And you can see the difference before and after. And the soil and groundwater was involved in these examples. So this is about groundwater. Groundwater decontamination is the most difficult process so far. And how you decontaminate the groundwater, the question is, there are two options that you have, pump and treat or something else. And frankly speaking, the groundwater decontamination is not well advanced yet in the technology. In most cases, pump and treat is being used. So, but also you need, for groundwater modeling, you need 3D modeling for the in order to assess the contaminant plumes, and then to see what kind of technology in 3D modeling in order to look to have visualization and then try to see the conceptual model for the plume and to look at the monitoring data and put those together in order to construct a visual aid for you in order to see how the plume is being spread around. Technology is also needed for remediation of groundwater. As I said, the current technology is pump and treat, but for your information, currently there is a new technology is being developed but is not well advanced. And this technology is called nanotechnology for using nanomaterials in order to inject it in the groundwater, capture the contamination, and then after that collect all of this material using nanomaterial to collect it back. And then this is now is being demonstrated in certain areas, but is still under development. It's not really complete yet. This is a new technology that for groundwater decontamination. And in the future, this could be an efficient technique for instead of having pump and treat and try to have so many monitoring wells. So this technology could be actually very useful to think about in the future. And under R&D, I think, needs further development. Finally, a vivid example of important technology is decommissioning of damaged reactors after severe accident. I will not spend much time because the previous speaker, thank you, Dr. Harimoto Yamana, he did explain that, so I will not go through this. But those are examples for two. This is for Chernobyl as well as another example, of course, for the Fukushima accident, and I will not spend time on those. The next slides they illustrate about the robotic and remote technologies that they have been developed in support of Fukushima. Again, it was talked about before. There is no need for me to cover this, but Jared Brun, he put this in his presentation slide. This is an example of confinement of the nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Again, lots of technology they have been used for that purpose. In conclusion, I will not read all of those conclusions if you like to take a look at it in the presentation slide, but three things I would like to mention that the technologies they are important and significant to consider in decommissioning because they lead to incremental improvement in decommissioning efficiency, enhancing safety, and reduction of cost. And number two, decommissioning of nuclear power plants after severe accidents is definitely they use innovative technologies, and we need to learn from it. And there are lots of technologies that have been developed, as was presented by the first presenter. And for subsurface remediation of land and groundwater, definitely, we need to think about more advanced technology that we can use. Thank you very much.
I'm going to do Stefan.
Can
you introduce him? Yeah, I'll introduce Stefan.
Okay.
Make it easy.
Thank you very much, Bobby, for filling in for Gerald Bruno. Our next speaker is Dr. Stefan Anton, who is Vice President of Engineering for Whole Tech International. In this role, Dr. Anton is responsible for providing technical and licensing leadership to all Whole Tech technical services departments engaged in the design and analysis functions. Dr. Anton has over 25 years of experience working in the nuclear industry in the U.S. and Germany, with a primary focus on spent fuel storage and transportation. Stefan?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, thanks for inviting me here to speak on this panel. So I'll be talking about a very specific technical aspect of the decommissioning, and that is the dry storage of spent nuclear fuel from the spent fuel pool, and there specifically about the advances that we have made in the previous years in the technologies to do that, and that in the end actually have an impact on the decommissioning strategies for the plants to be decommissioned. So I'll be going through some of the technical challenges and the solutions that have been developed over time by us and also by other companies that have been involved in this. Just as a background, in the interest of time, I'm not giving a company overview, but we are designer and manufacturer of spent fuel storage and transportation cars predominantly. Not only that, we of course have the certificates from the NRC for our systems. By now about 1,200 of our systems have been loaded here in the US. But we also provide the loading services to our clients, to the nuclear power plants. And therefore, we are directly involved or affected by what the plants are loading into the spent fuel pool when we're planning it with them. And over time, we've been optimizing this, and the advances that we've made there, they come to the point that it actually provides benefits in terms of the impact on the decommissioning strategies that are being used there. And that's what I've principally will be talking about. So my overview is just a very, very brief overview of our decommissioning strategies, focusing predominantly here on the U.S. And then I'll be talking about the technical details there first. And there, it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg situation. First, I'll talk about the spent fuel loading strategies for our dry storage system, how that has developed over time, depending on the different designs and the different calculational methodologies that have been developed over time. That's, of course, linked because we're loading in the end for a plant that is being decommissioned, we're loading what's in the spent fuel pool. So it's linked to the spent fuel pool inventories. The two things, they go together. I'll talk a little bit about the software that needed to be developed and this, and then I'll be summarizing this. Decommissioning strategies, again, I'm focusing predominantly here on the U.S. The traditional strategy is that the plant, after decommissioning, the plant is put into safe store. It's basically mothballed for an extended period of time, and only after all that time the spent fuel pools would be emptied and put into dry storage. By the time that happens, the fuel assemblies are relatively old and don't really present that much of a challenge storing it into dry storage. But the disadvantages doing this is that the final decommissioning would be really decades after the plant is shut down. When you want to do that faster, going into what can be called prompt decommissioning, so the activities would start almost immediately. For that, to support a much faster decommissioning, you need to be able to load the spent fuel assemblies from the spent fuel pool into dry storage much, much quicker. And by now, we are able to unload the entire spent fuel pool into dry storage in as little, in some cases, as 2 years after shutdown of the reactor. So the spent fuel loading into dry storage is then no longer the critical path for the decommissioning, so the site can be returned to whatever condition is earlier. So what's the main challenge here? Why hasn't been done that from the start? The main challenge is the decay heat of the fuel assemblies. If you have the fuel assemblies that are only 2 years or shorter cooled, the heat load is much, much higher, and that's what we have to address. In order to talk about how we deal with it from a technical perspective in the dry storage area, let me probably go a little bit through the history of how the system have been developed in the past, how fuel assemblies are loaded actually into dry storage system. And probably about 20 years ago when the dry storage system started, usually they would be loaded in a uniform way into the storage systems. Basically, all cells in the dry storage system would have the same ability, would permit the same heat load. Typically, the baskets that were used in there, they were made out of steel. The heat loads were not very high. 5 or 10 years cooling time would be required for the fuel assemblies. And the main goal, actually, at that point in time was not a decommissioning. It was basically a load just as much fuel assemblies from the spent fuel pool into dry storage to allow the plant to continue operation. So not very challenging. After that, I would say roughly between 2000 and 2015, the advances in the designs of the systems and in the calculational methods, they allowed higher heat loads to be loaded into the spent fuel storage systems. We used what was called regionalized loading, and I will show an example in a minute on one of the next slides there, that allows to actually load higher heat loads in there. The total heat loads of the dry storage systems, permissible heat load, would go up. So something in the range of even exceeding 30 kilowatt. And some of the baskets for that were still manufactured from steel, although gradually things were moved over to use aluminum-based materials for the storage of the fuel. The main goals at that point in time were still not decommissioning. At that time, still people didn't really focus too much on that. But one of the main goals was to reduce the dose rates around the storage systems. And so that you would place hotter assemblies in the inside. So it was kind of an optimization of the system in that respect. So finally, the situation that we have now in the light of decommissioning, the systems were independent of that, they were improved even further. Aluminum-based baskets are used to a large degree by now. They allow higher heat loads, and we now develop then optimized heat load patterns that are specifically focuses on unloading spent fuel pools as quick as possible. Cooling times of as little as 1 year cooling time for certain fuel assemblies can be achieved there, and the total heat load for a dry storage cask can be more than 40 kilowatt. So here now the main goal to load the entire spent fuel into inventory of a shutdown plant as early as possible to support a shorter decommissioning. At the same time, of course, you have to keep in mind is the heat load, which means the spent fuel temperatures, and also the dose rate around the cask. So that's one of the main focuses there. Let me show you on the next slide two examples that I have. These are examples from one of the baskets that we use in our system. It's a basket for 37 PWR assemblies, and they show heat loads of the permissible heat loads of the individual cells for each for two scenarios. On the left side, you see what we have called regionalized loading that has been used already extensively in the industry. And what you actually do in order to allow higher heat loads assemblies to be loaded in a certain area, you have this red area there. This is kind of an intermediate area where you can load fuel assemblies up to a heat load of about 1.7 kilowatt. On the outside of that, you have lower heat loads, and on the inside, you also have lower heat loads. So this allows you to load higher heat load assemblies, a limited number of higher heat load assemblies, without challenging the spent fuel temperature and without also challenging the dose rates around the system too much. And on the right side, this is now essentially the latest iteration on this. that allows even higher heat loads, where you basically each, this is just an example, you can assign a different heat load to each of individual cell in the basket, and due to the aluminum based material that is used for the basket, that still remains, that still ensures that the temperatures of the spent fuel pool of the spent fuel is below the regulatory limits there. From that, let me also then go into another area there. I might actually, in the interest of time, skip one slide here. This is about the spent fuel pool inventory, because it is important that your spent dry storage system matches up to the inventory that you have in your spent fuel pool. And to just give you an idea, I mean, this is about the. Let me go to the next slide. This is about uniform and regionalized storage. But the next one, that is for the multi-level strategy, where you have individual cell heat loads in each of the basket locations. You have, once you have your spent fuel pool after shutdown of the plant, and after a short time after that, you have a very diverse inventory in your spent fuel pool of your fuel in there. So you have, from your final shutdown, you typically have one-third burnt fuel with, let's say, 1 year cooling time, two-third burnt fuel, so two-cycle fuel with 1 year cooling time, and then you have fully burnt fuel with a short cooling time. And then you might, depending on your size of your spent fuel pool, you might have a large inventory of fuel with maybe going all the way out to 20 years. So you have a very, very diverse inventory in your spent fuel pool with very, very different heat loads. And that's basically the challenge, to load that into the dry storage system. And this is something that really can't. I mean, initially we tried to do these things by hand. It's a you have a spent fuel pool inventory. There are 2,000 fuel assemblies in there with all kind of different heat loads and different parameters. And we were trying to resolve this and put that into dry storage in an optimized way using some simple approaches there. And we very quickly found out that this is not really possible. So over the years, we developed the appropriate sophisticated loading plan software. Now, I'm personally not familiar with the plant operation, but yeah, there you have your software that calculates your reload strategies of your core, and in the end, loading your entire inventory of your spent fuel pool into dry storage is kind of a similar problem. And we've developed in the end the software to use that, and in the end, the goals for that would be you want to, of course, minimize the time to empty the spent fuel pool, but at the same time you want to make sure that all your regulatory requirements are met, specifically that none of your spent fuel, when it's loaded in the dry storage system, is above the temperature limits, the regulatory temperature limits. And you also want to see that you minimize your dose rates from an ALARA perspective. So it's a balance between several things, and you can only do that with the appropriate software. So I put a little graph on here. I apologize if it's not really that clear, but this came out of some experiments or some tests that we were running some time ago, and to load an entire spent fuel pool into dry storage, it's just, of course, a large number of casks. I think that would be loaded over a longer period of time. And as you see there, this was kind of a test that we were running, where casks, each of these dots present a cask, and that goes over a period of about 1.5 years or so, or almost 1 year. And the important feature is there. It shows there are two different scenarios, but the important feature is that the software is able to basically load each cask at about the same heap load. So we can make sure for each cask that, on the one hand, we are not exceeding any temperatures or any heat load limits, but at the same time that we're not giving away any margin in there by a suboptimal loading conditions. And the second one is where we have even a larger impact is the dose rates, because the program also looks at the dose rate around the cask when it places the fuel assembly in there. And with a large variety of the fuel assembly that we put in there, as I showed before, there might be 1 year cooled or 20 year old cooled. It has quite a substantial impact on the dose rates around the cask, and the program optimizes that. And we have here, this is an example, the top numbers, again, they are 30 casks that are loaded within a certain period of time, and we calculated the dose rate that would be experienced at the top of the cask, and we see that initially they were all about the same before we used the optimization, dose optimization, and after we then told the program to basically optimize for the dose rate and put the fuel assemblies in the best place in every cask to reduce the dose rates on the outside, we can get up to dose reductions of 20 or 30%, which is definitely something that is substantial. So in summary, there are a lot of technical advances that has been done over the 10, 15 years that allows a different loading, a different decommissioning strategy shortly after the shutdown of the plant, because you can actually load the fuel assemblies from the spent fuel pool into dry storage much faster than that was done initially. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stefan. Our last but not least speaker is Mr. Rodrigo Rimando, Jr. He is Senior Site Liaison in the U.S. DOE Environmental Management, Office of Environmental Management, and he has so much experience in the technology area, and this is as applied in the field. So we are happy to have him talking about the technology as applied and developed by DOE. Rod, you are welcome to come to the podium.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. I think I'm standing between you and lunch. So today is March 14. If you have not already been greeted, I will do so now. Happy Pi Day. So, all right. Let me go ahead and just jump into the presentation. The first topic I'll cover this morning is this business, our mission area of defense environmental cleanup. In doing so, I hope to place context on the ongoing need for science, technology, and innovation, particularly in the nuclear cleanup business. As a case study, I'll share with you one of our current decommissioning projects, and that is the decommissioning of the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, is where we will soon be deploying robotics to conduct the non-destructive assay of inactive uranium enrichment process pipes. Finally, I'll offer a few perspectives on robotics technology thrust. The mission of Office of Environmental Management is to save cleanup of the environmental legacy left by the Manhattan Project, the ensuing Cold War nuclear arms race, and the early years of federal government-sponsored nuclear science research and technology development. Our mission is divided into six general areas: nuclear facility decommissioning, the cleanup of the impact of soil and groundwater, as well as surface water. And we're also responsible for dispositioning over 90 million gallons of highly radioactive and chemically reactive liquid waste. Including with that mission is the disposal of our solid radioactive waste. We operate several low-level waste disposal facilities on our various facilities. We're also responsible for the temporary storage and disposition over 2,000 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel and a large inventory of special nuclear materials. And finally, and certainly equally important, we continually seek innovative solutions to improve on our mission. Our initial cleanup footprint spanned 30 states and U.S. territories that were home to about 130 major sites and facilities with well over 10,000 individual release sites and waste units. Initially, we estimated that it would take about 75 years, on the order of $200 to $350 billion to complete our mission, And when we were chartered in 1989, there were many, many uncertainties and assumptions with that work. Even more problematic was that we did not have the technology or the solutions to accomplish that cleanup, particularly for those units that were contaminated with both radioactive materials as well as chemicals. 30 years later, after investing over $170 billion, we've completed cleanup at 91 of our 107 formal sites. And over that 30-year period, we've made some pretty significant strides in reducing the risk and, mitigating the risk to human health and the environment. As far as our decommissioning, we have a wealth of decommissioning experience at the Hanford site located in eastern Washington. It was a home of our first production reactors, plutonium production reactors. Since that Cold War, we've decommissioned. We've placed six of those nine reactors in interim safe storage. One of the reactors was actually converted. It has historical significance. It is now accessible to the public for public tours. At Savannah River site, located in South Aiken, South Carolina, where it's home to five more production reactors. Two have since been entombed and closed in place where they will remain under federal control in perpetuity. The other three have been repurposed, serving several of EM and DOE's missions. In terms of our decommissioning test reactors and research reactors, we have more than 75 that are in various designs or, phases of decommissioning, and many have been closed. The running video there is the removal of the confinement dome from the heavy water components test reactor at Savannah River site. Back up real quick. We also have a lot of experience decommissioning non-reactor facilities. We've decommissioned well over 715 of those, to include the gaseous diffusion plant down on Oak Ridge, which is shown in the top left video, the vitrification plant at the West Valley Demonstration Project in upstate New York, and the K reactor cooling tower at Savannah River site. By the way, we don't always use explosives to demolish our facilities, but they do make for some pretty good video there. What's left? So we still have 16 major sites to clean up. We estimate that it will take actually well over 50 years and well over $250 billion. We've had some recent estimates that have certainly escalated that, one of which appeared in a GAO report recently. Suffice to say, we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We're not even halfway through. And in many cases, we still have a lot of heavy lifting in terms of the nature and the type of contaminants that we have to deal with. So let me shift now to the gaseous diffusion plant. That plant is located in southern Ohio, and it's in Piketon, Ohio, actually. And for those of you that are familiar with that part of the country or, this plant in particular, we affectionately say that it's at the intersection of no and where. So there's a reason why we place these facilities where we do. The plant itself occupies over 3,700 acres. Of about 1,200 acres are industrialized, about 415 buildings. It was built to produce enriched uranium, including weapons-grade uranium, through the gaseous diffusion of uranium hexafluoride to separate the lighter isotope of U-235 from the heavier isotope of U-238. The plant itself produced enrichment levels up to 97.65% U-235 and lower enrichments of about 3%. The main process buildings are, colored there, X-333, X-330, and X-326. We recently completed the characterization of X-326, and we're now moving into the characterization of X-333, which is the larger of the three facilities. That building, pictured here, has about 2.8 million square feet of floor space, which is pretty sizable. The Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, I think, is 2 million. So quite amount of material that we have to deal with, certainly in terms of characterization and ultimately decommissioning. It houses the largest process equipment that we have. As a frame of reference, those pedestals that you see at the bottom, the pedestals of the converters, they're about 5 feet tall. So one thing that you'll also notice is that all of the piping, or essentially all of the piping, is located in the overhead. We have over 15 miles of that piping, and one of the particular challenges is our large piping, those that are 30-inch in diameter and 42 inches in diameter. We have about 5.5 miles of those to deal with. And therein lies the challenge. We have to assay these equipment. Again, we're talking about enriched uranium quantities, residues, so there certainly is the concern for nuclear criticality safety, radiological safety, and ultimately waste disposal. The current method, as what's kind of depicted there, is to take a radiac and hand survey them on the external of the piping. So not only are we challenged with their locations relative to the building, but of course it's an old building. Most of the areas that we would have to survey are contamination areas, so these workers, NDA techs, decommissioning workers, and our QC, QA inspectors typically dressed out in full anti-contamination clothing to include air-fed respirators. So the challenge becomes, how can we do this non-destructive assay safer, cheaper, and easier? So PCAMS, pipe crawling activity measurement system, is our solution. It's a turnkey system for automatically and autonomously conducting the NDA of U-235 residues. RAD Piper is configured to assay 30-inch diameter piping and can be reconfigured on the fly to assay 42-inch piping without equipment modification, equipment realignment, or even sensor calibration. RAD Piper is deployed via delivery system that includes scissor lifts and launch rigs. In the video, RAD Piper is undergoing full-scale mock-up testing and demonstration for both 42-inch and 30-inch configurations at elevation. This particular demonstration was done at the Field Robotics Center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Here's an expanded view of RAD Piper. RAD Piper, again, is an autonomous pipe crawling activity or pipe crawling platform that obtains and logs radiometric, autometric, geometric, and visual data. It is equipped with a discollimated gamma detector and 8 onboard non-spectroscopic sensors. It has a visual camera, LED array, a planar laser profiler, a laser range finder, some encoders, a 3D mapper, and some distance sensors. As far as the assembly itself, the disc collimated detector assembly really has three main components. Of course, the detector itself, and then two 18-inch diameter aluminum-backed lead discs, which serves as the method of collimation, and a QE's check source of americium 241. For the 30-inch pipe, the collimation assembly provides an 18.5-inch main annulus view with tails of 1.7 inches on both ends. And for the 42-inch pipe, the collimation assembly provides an 11-inch main view with tails of, looks like, 3.5 inches. RAD Piper is equipped with a fisheye lens to make this images from within the pipe. The bottom video shows the basic operation of the camera and lighting system taking still photos at about 1 second, about 1 hertz. The top video is actual footage from a newly interrogated process pipe during one of our demonstrations. So we did a hot demonstration where RAD Piper was actually deployed in one of our actual process piping, and that's the video that we see. So this was quite fascinating for us, particularly because we really didn't have a good sense of what the interior surfaces looked like. In terms of the geometry profile, RAD Piper generates a geometric map of the pipe segment that is being assayed. Point cloud visualizations obtained from LIDAR as RAD Piper traverses the pipe. What's shown there to the left is a point cloud image created by the LIDAR system as RAD Piper was sitting just outside the pipe, and it picked up what you see there is one of our workers and the columns on the cell floor. In terms of localization, pipe position is very important as we assay these pipe segments. We use two types of sensors. We have a single-point laser rangefinder coupled with some track encoders to determine the precise location of the robot within the piping. The user interface, pretty simple. We've tried to make it as simple as possible. It's simply a Windows-based wireless tablet that the NDA technician uses. The NDA technician records and verifies information about the pipe segment and then initiates the survey by simply launching RadPiper. It's at this point that the data acquisition scheme is performed automatically and autonomously. Oh, by the way, that 3D model is not part of the tablet display. I put that on there just to show the capabilities of the LiDAR and how we use that to overlay some of the visual imaging that we get. PCAMS is a finite state machine, so after the decommissioning operators have positioned RadPiper, they manually energize it, and RadPiper enters its first state, of idle. The NDA technician from the wireless tablet then launches RadPiper, at which time it executes its first series of QC checks. RadPiper then automatically transitions to the forward state, self-launches, and begins its data acquisition. When the sensors detect the end of the pipe segment or the survey length of interest, it transitions to the approach state and then stops. It then goes into its backward state and returns to the home. Upon its return to the starting point, it goes into the final QC check and completes and compares operating data from the first QC check. And finally, it automatically goes into the backward error state if it detects any one of those listed errors. All data is stored automatically and immediately onto an onboard removable thumb drive. After the HP tech and Rad tech clears the thumb drive, it's delivered to the NDA tech for data download and automatic post-processing and archiving. The data set is then available for the NDA techs and the QA inspectors to review. This is just a simple example of how the data can be queried and displayed at the workstation. The system does identify flags, so we do look for data anomalies as well as QC flags. And on our review, we can go through any kind of query to investigate and resolve those potential discrepancies and resolve the flags. This is just a simple example of a data report that is automatically generated. Once it's approved, it's permanently archived. So what do we expect? By using PCAMS or RAB's Piper instead of the current baseline method of MDA, we expect the following benefits. We still get quality data. That means NQA-1 consensus standard. We greatly enhance our safety posture, including lowering our occupational exposure to ionizing radiation. So there is a huge ALARA component to this. We'll be able to conduct the NDA and produce quality data much, much faster than what we have done in the past, particularly at X-326. Initially, our cost savings projections range anywhere from $10 to $50 million per facility, so that's for X-333, and we would expect similar, if not more, as we transition to X-330. And, of course, we'll have much better data. So I'll close with the final remarks. In terms of where we're heading next, once we get this commissioned, we already have new designs in place and other capabilities being considered for the next generation of them. Just as a thought here, the technological advancements and breakthroughs in all these other different complementary fields really are lending itself to the rapid evolution of robotics. The fusion of these technologies have enabled certainly new tools like PCAMS and RadPiper. Most of the robotics that we have played today are focused on high hazard, high consequence tasks and trying to eliminate them. But what I would offer that there are many, many other applications, very broad relevance and utility for these types of tools. And I'm getting cues to keep it going, so one last closing remark. I didn't put a label on here, but collaboration, cooperation, partnership, teaming, whatever you want to call it, getting people together to work towards a common solution is actually the single most accomplishment of this particular project. Thank you very much. I got to end with this video, right, or this final clip.
Thank you.
In the spirit of robotics, HAL, 2001 Space Odyssey, this briefing is terminated, certainly mine anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Rod. That's a really detailed presentation. Lots of work, lots of activities. Now we will have some time in order to entertain questions. So if you have any questions, please fill the cards and give it to us. So we have the first question to Dr. Ayamana. Is what are the cleanup levels for soil and groundwater that were required by the regulator, and what are the key technologies used for remediation? Because remediation of soil in our case is quite important. If you can just let us just briefly describe the new technologies. Thank you.
Well, I'd say it is not decided yet, because this is a terribly damaged site, mm-hmm. and it is outside the regular regulation for the sound facilities. So the HELSI reactor for the site release standard for the normal reactor is 300 microsieverts per year mm-hmm. for the public. Yeah. So this may be a similar standard for the accident facility, but it is still being discussed in the regulation authority.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have other question to Stefan. How many plants have begun looking at individual cell decay heat limits, and what plants, if any, are implementing this new technology that you presented?
Well, I'm not quite sure whether I can talk about the plans, but we've implemented that at a number of plans, and for many of our clients, specifically if they're going into decommissioning, it is an offer that we're making to them, and I think that's it's usually well received because it can optimize the system.
Great. Why don't you go to the question cards?
Thank you. I have one question for Rod. Can these technologies that you mentioned provide a basis for confirming the success of dismantling and remediation activities for high hazard challenges involving radioactive contamination?
So I think I understand the question. The answer is yes. So these robotic solutions, these remote systems, again have broad application. So for us in EM, we're using them more frequently now to support our characterization. But there will be a time where we'll be using them much more for the actual decommissioning. We're already deploying robotic arms, for example, to help with the cleanup of our underground storage tanks, particularly our high-level waste tanks. We've used them for repair of damaged facilities in some of our more highly radioactive facilities, like our vitrification facility in Savannah River. Again, if you step away just from trying to avoid direct contact, but think about the types of tasks that you don't want to do or don't like doing, robotics is well suited for it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We have also a question from the audience to Rod. They are asking about what was the hardest cleanup that completed by DOE and why? That's a tough question.
Oh, that's a loaded question. So we have certainly had our share of challenges. One of the rather large accomplishments was closing the plutonium facility in Rocky Flats, Colorado. Now, that does not mean that, and I do not intend to deminimize the accomplishments in Ohio, for example, where we closed our Fernald facility, another major high hazard facility. We have our radiochemical processing facilities. While we really haven't gotten into the cleanup yet, we've done much to remove the material at risk, like F Canyon down at Savannah River and some of the plants at Hanford. So, again, over the 30-year period, we've done a pretty admirable job in reducing the risks associated with these facilities and trying to put them in as a safe and stable configuration as we can until we can get the funding to actually ultimately demolish them or decommission them. By the way, our cleanup program is funded by public dollars, so we do not generate revenue. The taxpayer funds our work, so we have to be very judicious in how we execute those public funds. And, of course, we have finite budgets each year, and we try to maximize our work as much as possible. A large part of that, for decommissioning in particular, has been to reduce those impending risks.
Thank you. Question for Dr. Yamano.
Yeah.
What is the most surprising insight gained as part of the decommissioning process for Fukushima facilities?
Insight.
Like, you know, what kind of insight?
I'd say it's too early to say about that.
Okay.
Yeah, but one thing important is there is lots of uncertainty, lots of unknowns, lots of unknown unknowns. Mm-hmm. So everything is unclear. So we have to challenge this very complicated situation.
Mm-hmm.
This is the insight, isn't it?
Thank you. Another question for Dr. Yamane from the audience. How did you manage worker dose during decommissioning and cleanup operations at Fukushima? Worker dose.
Well, Tokyo Electric Power has a kind of standard for the dose limit for one worker that is decided by the law. Mm-hmm. So they will very stringently keep that. Okay. And so, however, the workers are limited, you know, numbers are limited. They have to think about the total dose for long operation.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it the dose budget. Okay, so they think about how they should lower than a certain dose budget.
Okay.
Sorry, my English isn't.
Thank you.
No, that's very good. Thank you.
The other question from the audience. They are asking all the panelists, it says that, are these experiences of dismantling while having spent fuel in the pool? So they are talking about spent fuel, and you are doing all of those activities. What is the opinion of the regulator? So we'll try to see now what the panelists, they think of that having all of these operations while spent fuel in the pool. I think the question is, what kind of risk or what kind of how the operation can be improved? That's the question. So if, like the panelists, you like to talk about specifically about spent fuel.
Stefan?
Well, I mean, from our perspective,
Stefan, yeah.
I mean, this is specifically what we're trying to do to get the fuel out of the spent fuel pool as early as possible. And I can't talk about other parts of the decommissioning, but that's really the area, so that you have it, if the fuel is already out there, and then I believe that many things in your decommissioning will then be easier, because you don't have to worry about your fuel in the spent fuel pool anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Rod, do you have any insights?
So I'll be a little bit snide in my comment in that, give me a federal repository to put our spent fuel and we'll advance our decommissioning program. So in all honesty, so what we're, of course, and many nuclear power plants are in the situation where we're just running out of wet storage space. We're now, and by the way, all our vitrified waste is also supposed to go to a federal repository. So while the commercial nuclear power has a challenge of its spent fuel, we also have the challenge of vitrifying our high-level waste into these glass logs. At Savannah River, we're about to run out of storage We're even looking at alternate methods to store our glass logs. So it is truly a national problem. One of the ways that you can help us alleviate our risk and reduce that taxpayer burden, that environmental liability, is give us a federal repository.
Thank you. I have a question. It looks like to NRC. That's the question. So so the question is raised, okay, you are talking in general, just I will summarize it. It's very difficult to read, but the way I read from it that, well, you are talking about all of these technologies and development and so on, and the question is, okay, how is NRC can have competency in their inspection and review in considering all of these technologies? I cannot answer this question, but I think our review, the licensee, they can do whatever they want to do, but we look at the PSDAR. We are not supposed to have official comments on the PSDAR post-shutdown activities, but we look into that and we see if there is anything that raises our concern, maybe we can discuss that. And the PSDR discussed with the public, too, for the activities, including the fueling, of course, and all of those activities. Now, the question is, what kind of technology we can enforce to use? We do not have what's called requirement for BAT, best available technology, as UK. But definitely, we would encourage, specifically for remediation of material, that to look into the advanced technology, and it is up to the operator and the licensee to select based on safety, based on cost effectiveness, and based on the what kind of technology available that they can use. NRC major concern is safety. That's really what we look at. That's the summary of response to that question.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I think we'd like
John,
to...
Do you have questions?
Well, I'd like to thank everybody on the panel for coming here from Japan and from everywhere to inform us. And the last question, I think, really kind of shows the objective of this session was to learn about these new technologies and to become familiar with them. So we want to thank you all for being here for 90 minutes, for your questions and your attention. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you very much.